Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Class War Battlefield podcast. Please do me the honor of supporting this work that I am doing. I've been doing this work now for free on your behalf for, my God, 11 years. 5, 10, 20, 50. If you can afford it, please do. Cash at me at $CWB Podcast. CWB Podcast. Cash App it. CWB Podcast. Also, hit me up on PayPal. CWB Podcast. All the way across the board, y'all. Help me out. Thank you for donating and enjoy the show.
American Psycho is a 2000 adaptation of the Bret Easton Ellis novel of the same name. It's dark, sometimes funny, insightful, and has led to a number of ridiculous internet memes. In short, it's a good movie and worth our attention. It tells the story of Patrick Bateman, played by a pre-Batman Christian Bale. He's a businessman at something called Pierce & Pierce, which is never fully explained in the film. He treats everything like something he can own, including people. He sees women as meat, and business associates as potential victims. Oh, he's utterly insane. He says so. Though this analysis will avoid some of the larger spoilers. American Psycho is full of themes and messages. Owing to Ellis' novel, the shallow 80s and the cold-hearted business tactics of its era are targeted in this picture. The violence scene in the picture can be viewed as a visceral, shocking mirror of the cutthroat capitalism above all business practices of the decade. Although the story is not just a weapon to be used against such things, it also contains personal introspection. Of the novel, Ellis himself once said, "I was slipping into a consumerist kind of void that was supposed to give me confidence and make me feel good about myself, but just made me feel worse and worse and worse about myself." There is also an interpretation that Patrick Bateman may be a closeted gay man and that he is repressing his desires. Another character is definitely a homosexual and even comes on to Bateman in a bathroom, misinterpreting Bateman's seemingly violent advances for flirting. The other man is rebuffed, and Bateman does not sleep with him, but he certainly does approach his potential victim with a lot more care and gentleness than the others. So there may be something to that. Again, Ellis once said of his audience, "If they knew I was gay, American Psycho would be read as a different book." Some even interpret Patrick Bateman as a stand-in for President Ronald Reagan, especially in the film where we see a shot of Reagan on television and then a shot at Bateman. It's a movie steeped in the 80s, but not in a nostalgic way. More in the way that one has post-traumatic stress about something that was so terrible we would very much like to forget it if we could. There is a lot bubbling under the surface of this story, but just for clarity, the focus today will be mainly on the film, not the novel, and how individuality, conformity, and loss of identity play into this adaptation. There are many, many examples, and if one is only watching American Psycho as a high-class slasher film, they could easily be missed. Early in the film, Bateman is riding in a taxi with his girlfriend, Evelyn, played by a young Reese Witherspoon. She asks him why he continues to work at his job. Without missing a beat, Bateman answers, "I want to fit in." This is key. Bateman's voiceover narration gives the audience clues that he does not see himself as a unique individual, that he is not real, but Bateman actually voicing his desires for conformity to another character sets the tone for the movie. In a later scene, when discussing the popular 1980s song "Hip to Be Square" by Huey Lewis and the News, he makes a remark about the pleasures of conformity. He says it only in passing and while dancing around the room, but it is critical to his character. Conformity is everything to Bateman. In one scene, he talks to a homeless man and asks him about his life and how he came to live on the streets. Bateman at first speaks of helping him, perhaps teasing him about giving him a hand, and then realizing and saying that they have nothing in common, we see Bateman stab him. Bateman hates him because he is different from him. His desire for conformity stretches out into homicidal thoughts. There are other things that bolster this interpretation. His credit card is exactly like those of his other colleagues. There is no deviation. All platinum. all identical. It's a wonder they don't get their cards mixed up. The fact that some of his associates have different business cards upset him. To Bateman, every businessman must have an expensive business card, but the others are colored slightly differently, and this, to Bateman, cannot be. He is also devoted to the popular music of that day. When he is alone listening to it on his headphones, Bateman does not appear to enjoy it. He is stone-faced, almost as if he is doing research about what is mainstream. But when discussing it with Paul Allen and later with Christine, he speaks about its depth, not realizing that much of the popular music of the 80s was shallow tripe. Yet he talks about it lovingly because it is what everyone else likes. Bateman mentions high-priced designer names and restaurants quite a bit, placing their value solely on the fact that other people want those things. He does not seem to care, but when he finds other people able to get reservations at a restaurant and he cannot, he finds he is not achieving his aforementioned goal of fitting in, and this sends him into a rage. In the first voiceover narration, Bateman notes that he often wears a mask in which to keep his face the way it was when he was younger. He doesn't want to change. To Bateman, change is bad. Everything must be the same, the way it always was. No alterations. Must look young. Must look like everyone else. Same haircut, too. Everyone has slicked back hair. No deviations there either. Bateman needs slicked back hair as well. Wearing a mask also speaks to loss of personal identity, which comes up in various scenes in the film. Bateman is addressed by the wrong name early on because he says he works in the same department as the person for whom he was mistaken. Instead of correcting this, he accepts it and uses everyone's lack of understanding of the individual in his favor. He, too, is perfectly content to use a different name because to Bateman, everyone is the same and nobody matters. In fact, name mix-ups happen often in this picture. It's recurring. Nobody is important enough to have their own name and own identity. Further, names are not even given weight enough for Bateman to believe they should exist at all. The character Christine was mentioned earlier, but that is not her real name. Bateman assigned that name to her because her name was inconsequential to him. For Patrick Bateman, human beings are not special. Not one person is significant. Nobody. If nobody matters, if nobody is an individual, if nobody is of any consequence and their lives are meaningless, Bateman is content with the idea of treating them that way. We see what he really thinks of human beings in the callous way he treats women and, of course, in the more violent scenes in the picture. If nobody is unique, we are all just copies and therefore not worth saving, not worth keeping, may as well discard after our usefulness has expired. Although it is never said, that appears to be the mindset of Patrick Bateman. American Psycho is many things, but it seems to be a cautionary tale about devaluing something or somebody by not seeing its significance or individuality. Without significance, there is no attachment, and without attachment, we stop caring.
We want every American to know the dignity of a hard day's work. We can lift our citizens from welfare to work, from dependence to independence.
This is Hard Work U, where they really do work really hard. They love our country, they love faith, they love values, and they love working hard.
It's indicative of a problem in our culture where we've started to sideline this notion of personal responsibility.
Yes.
And personal responsibility, as a foundation of our culture, it's important because it leads to empowerment. It gives us the agency to control our own destiny.
If a young person believes that the climate, the global warming problem on the climate is something that needs to be tackled quickly, and they can't wait until they grow up and become prime ministers to do it, do you think collective responsibility overrides individual responsibility in a huge issue like that?
No.
Have you ever been told to pull yourself up by your bootstraps? Ever heard someone chastise the poor for making bad decisions or praise the rich for making good ones? How many times have you heard someone assert that the US is the best country on earth because of our individual freedom? These are all part of the same phenomenon. And while present in some cultures outside the US, the mindset is particularly intense here. In this episode, we're going to take a brief look at individualism and consider why it's a deeply flawed worldview. Individualism is in the air we breathe. We watch movies about individual heroes saving the day. We are taught that history is made by individual great men. And we read think pieces about how individuals and poverty make good or bad choices. Because this ideology is so universally accepted, it has earned the label of common sense, even suggesting that individuals may not be primarily, much less entirely, responsible for their circumstances is cause for mockery and dismissal. To blame structures or systems or society is seen as childish weakness, as an attempt to shield yourself or others from accountability. The trouble is that individualism is an utterly absurd way of explaining the world. In 2018, a group of Harvard researchers analyzed data from the US Census and attempted to find correlations between a person's life story and their current income. They discovered that there was such a strong connection between the place someone is born and their future income that they put together a map called the Opportunity Atlas, which shows the median incomes of people born in each zip code, and even predicts what those incomes will be in the future. In 2015, another study found a similar link between your future income and your parents' wealth. The report stated, "The wage gap for people from different backgrounds is significant. The expected income of people raised in well-off families in the 90th percentile, that is, the top 90% of the national median household income, is about 200% larger than the expected income of children raised in poor families, in the 10th percentile, and about 75% larger than that of children raised in middle-class families, in the 50th percentile. What's more, people raised in middle-class families will earn close to double what children from lower-income families earn in adulthood. Put simply, by combining these studies, sociologists are able to predict your lifetime income based on the zip code you were born in and how much money your parents make. Not based on how hardworking you are, not based on your personal qualities or capitalist instincts. No, the circumstances of your birth are the single largest predictors of your financial success. If everyone truly were entirely or even mostly in control of their destiny, if the myth of individualism were true, how could that be possible? The ridiculousness of the equal opportunity and individual success story becomes even clearer when we look at the supposedly self-made people that individualists point to as proof. Elon Musk, supposedly an Iron Man-style brain genius, enjoyed family wealth from apartheid businesses which he has translated into two companies which abuse government subsidies and profit from wasteful non-solutions to climate change. Bill Gates, the founding father of self-made tech moguls, was one of the first students in America to have his own computers, and had direct connections to tech corporations through his father. But those are just modern examples. If you'd like a truly telling example, a 2016 study found that between the years 1427 and 2016, Florence, Italy has been ruled by the same families. That is a period of 600 years, at least 12 generations, in which the plague, the Renaissance, the Industrial Revolution, two world wars, the creation of capitalism, and modern technology itself has failed to disrupt Florence's structures of wealth and power. If the story of individual hard work determining success, or the inverse story of laziness causing failure, were true, surely one child in those 12 generations of Florentine elites would have been born without the magical hard work juice which we are told determines success. The notion of equal opportunity we are constantly being sold on is incompatible with any heritable family wealth, much less 600 years of it. And what about bigotry? How can we claim that anyone has enough power over their life path to punish them for failure when we know for a fact that racism, sexism, and discrimination wildly change your opportunities in life? Being a woman drastically affects your likely type of future employment, decreases your future income, and determines whether you spend years of your life doing domestic work, both paid and unpaid. Black Americans are born with roughly 8 times less family wealth, are underrepresented in elections, even after votes are counted, and are far more likely to face both hiring and workplace discrimination compared to white Americans. Race and employment type are deeply linked. In 2019, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics found that Hispanic Americans are nearly twice as likely to work service, construction, or industrial jobs as their white peers, and therefore twice as likely to face the health problems that kind of employment causes. Health outcomes, including life expectancy and future mental health issues, are connected to your race, your gender identity, and the zip code you were born in. Black communities, as one example, are far more likely to be subjected to toxic lead paint and unclear water, both of which can cause lifelong illnesses. Transgender people are much more likely to face depression as a result of being unable to transition or because of the bigotry they face from some corners of society. Both groups are more likely to be murdered outright, often by the police, and far less likely to have those murders solved. Conservatives and liberals alike have been repeating for generations that individuals, not structures, are to blame for human suffering. Reagan proclaimed that government is the problem, never the solution. Thatcher asserted that there is no such thing as society. But if this is the case, if the storybook protagonist-centered tales we tell are real, how can we possibly explain the mountains of statistically significant links between race, poverty, gender, and birth location to future health, wealth, and happiness? how can we explain why some countries, namely the ones with more socialist policies, have such low rates of poverty and homelessness, while others hop from crisis to crisis every year? Could it be coincidence? Sheer chance? Or, as argued by the likes of Ben Shapiro, pseudoscientific debunked bigotry? The most basic facts of modern life utterly contradict anti-systemic individualist thinking. To highlight that contradiction, let's try to explain these facts with individualist logic. Women and non-white people, by sheer coincidence, all individually chose to be paid less for more demanding jobs. Also by coincidence, they chose to work those jobs and be paid less than women and non-white people in other similarly developed countries. Simultaneously, people born in the same zip codes all just happened to make choices that led them to similar incomes, similar lifespans, and similar rates of disease. Those born to poor families chose, with little or no outside influence, to work lower-paying jobs. The rich also chose, of their own accord and without significant systemic advantages, to work higher-paying jobs. The huge differences in the inequalities between America and other wealthy nations is also a coincidence caused by Americans choosing to be lazier. Rather than consider that centuries of enslavement and systemic racism has sabotaged the quality of life for Black Americans, individualists insist that Black individuals choose to live in poverty more frequently than non-Black people. Rather than consider that society exists, individualists have created a web of absurdities and chosen to live there. They also insist that none of these absurdities are racist, sexist, or classist. We shouldn't temper our language here. Anyone who claims that individual choices rather than systems entirely determine how most people live should be dismissed outright. It's an embarrassing and absurd worldview, and even the tiniest bit of research should make that clear. I've left some links to further reading in the description. Like many aspects of American capitalism, individualism is a worldview created not to explain the world, but to control it. It's designed to fragment strong communities, turn workers against each other, and diminish the power of solidarity among the people. When you see yourself as the morally upright hero and everyone else as competition, you're turning your back on what it means to be human. There's plenty to go around, or at least there would be if it weren't all funneled straight to the top, to the people who manufactured the idea of individualism. Make no mistake, this worldview does not benefit you. We all need to make an attempt at deprogramming ourselves, of casting off decades of toxic individualist propaganda, and rebuild the ideals of unity and solidarity.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your brother, Ryan Mirkees. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode. Today, I want to speak with you about a topic that is a little frightening. To be honest with you, I never thought I'd be using this podcast to be talking about this subject. And it is the subject of choosing to save yourself and then choosing to save others. This is going to be a bit scattered brain, as a lot of these podcast episodes are. I go many different places. But I want to start off by paying tribute to the elders within my community who kind of inspired this. Dr. Obata Shaka, Dr. Karen Hunter, Dr. Greg Carr, who really kind of put the idea in my mind. Now, as a person who grew up around a lot of white folks who were hyper-Christian, the idea of saving was very prevalent and present. Both of my parents, both whom were black, had various religious experiences and various religious backgrounds. My mother and father both had to attend Catholic school. My father dropped out of school when he was in eighth grade. My mother went to Catholic school until she was in 10th grade, and then she dropped out. One of the worst mistakes she ever made, she told me. Don't do what I did. Neither one of them were overly religious. Absolutely, we had a Bible in the house. We did not have a Quran. Well, we had multiple Bibles in the house. And though it wasn't overwhelmingly so, some Christian principles were clearly innate in how the house was run. I remember one time asking my parents, what would they say if I wanted to get saved? And they said, it's your choice. You could if you want to. Now, we didn't attend church very often. Periodically, we would, and we would always attend a black church. Because, as my mother found out years later, when she did start to attend church regularly, and I apologize for those of you who fit this category, I mean no disrespect, but white churches are pretty dull. And I mean really no disrespect, but they really are. I mean, I've been to white churches that have the preacher singing up there, you know, white churches that kind of try to reproduce the black experience, and it's just, it's not the same to me. It's just not the same. But it's what it is. So this was how I became familiarized with the idea of saving, you know, was through, you saved through Jesus Christ in order to go to God. Years later, when studying Dr. King, I realized how important personal freedom and choice was in relationship to the idea of saving. And how a person, and there are various examples of this throughout history, who started off walking the Jesus path could far outpace it. And can, as I used to say, let go of Jesus' hand and grab God's and start to walk with God. I remember bringing this up to a friend of mine who was very well churched. This white woman, she had been going to church periodically, but religiously, at least once a month since she was a little girl. And when I brought up this idea to her, she said, but that's impossible because, you know, Jesus is God. I go, yeah, Jesus said that he is his father. But Jesus often talked to God. That means God is an aspect apart from Jesus. And Jesus even recognized that, which he didn't necessarily believe. But I said, but look, beyond that, Jesus is God, fine. But if Jesus himself says that I am the gateway to my Father, that means that there's a separation there. And sooner or later, you're going to let his hand go, the concept of Jesus at least, and you're going to start walking all together with God. Is that not the truth? Yeah, that absolutely. Absolutely. And I go, and that's possibly what makes a decently good Christian different from a great, powerful, history-bending Christian. Is one holds on to Jesus like he's a safety blanket, and then the other one of Jesus and starts to walk with God. Okay, I can believe that. Well, now let's go to the idea of saving. When we talk about saving, we say Jesus can only save. Obviously, clearly. And I'm going to expand this a little bit because this conversation happened nearly 20 years ago. I can't even believe I'm saying that, but it did happen in 2006. But I'm only going to expand it at the end because that's really all I need to do. So I said to her, you know, we have to make a choice to allow Jesus to save us, right? Right. Yes, true. I go, many people who go through what they call conversion talk about the first conversion. And then they went through other conversions along the way. Have you ever heard about that? And she thought about it. And she said, oh, yeah, it's kind of like the Catholic thing, right? And I go, yeah. She said, yeah, I've heard of that. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I go, and then there's this point where it seems that it's less Jesus that you're conversion that you're converting for and more for God. You ever heard of that? Yeah, I've heard of that. And I go, so do you see the connection between the personal aspect of saving where you make a choice? You let yourself turn over. You let yourself become something new. Not for Jesus' benefit anymore, but for God's benefit. Yeah, okay, I got you. I like, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm moving away from all that now, by the way, guys. We are experiencing a moment in history where at a singular, individualized level, the cellular portion of society, which is actually the family unit, but for the sake of this argument, I'm going to say the individual human being. Note, I do not say the individual person much anymore, but the individual human being has to make a decision on whether or not they want to save themselves. Save themselves from what? A lot of Christians are going to poo-poo this. They're going to say that, you know, this is God's great plan. And I've said many times before, God gave us the ability to prophesize and to see so that we do not have to experience certain things. And the prophecies are nigh about climate change. We have to choose on whether or not we are going to allow climate change to spin out of control. Now, many of you do not, especially conservatives, believe that climate change is a man-made disease placed upon this planet. That's fine with me. Let's talk about Palestine or Palestine. I don't even know. They pronounce, what is Palestine weird? Palestine? Yeah, they pronounce it weird. But that town in Ohio where there was a chemical spill. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there is deep concern by the train company that the people in that town are going to sue them because the chemicals that were spilled are known to cause some pretty severe environmental disastrous effects, and some horrible effects on human beings. They know this. The company, the train company, which is very wealthy, may I say, they know that there is going to be problems 10, 15, 20 years down the road. So what they are doing presently is they are offering people $1,000 and people have to sign paperwork in order to say, I'm not going to sue. Now, recently, I know, the CEO came out and said, nobody's doing that. Please. Of course they're doing that. Oh, they're just signing a piece of paper that says that they received the money. Color me not believing him. But okay, maybe he's telling the truth. I want to use this as a case in point. For those of you who say that mankind, just it's impossible for mankind to have affected the planet terribly in a way that would actually change the way that the planet works. If this town, Palestine, I really don't know how to say it other than Palestine, if there was only one town over the last 500 years, or one town a year, or maybe 10 towns a year throughout the world, that have experienced this type of cataclysmic disaster that will have decades-long effects on the local environment and the local people from that environment, then you would have a significant argument. But see, why you do not understand that it's that mankind has had a significant impact on the environment. One is because I really think that a lot of people are just in denial. I've been there, watching a loved one die, not wanting to believe that they're actually dying. I've been there. With you, it's a little bit different because for 5,000 years and longer, you've been buying into this notion that the people at the top of your European society know what the heck they're talking about. And frankly, I think it goes back a lot further than that. And they don't. They've been lying to you. They have been lying to you. And they've been obscuring for a long time the actual impacts of their system. Let's stay with the train derailment in Palestine, or Palestine, whatever they call it down there. Sorry. How many of you knew that last year there was over 1,000 similar derailments? Maybe stuff didn't spill out, but there were similar derailments throughout the country. 1,000. It's likely that probably 10% of those spilled to some extent, and actually I think I read significantly more than that, but I'm just going to use 10%. Yet you did not hear about those spills. Nearly 100 spills, if there was only 10% of them, nearly 100 spills, a little bit over 100 spills, you didn't hear about them. Well, maybe because they weren't that bad. Or maybe they were, and they just weren't covered. There are hundreds of oil leaks with pipelines throughout the country, to say nothing about the world, every year, that you don't hear about. So, and plus, there are thousands of landfills that are emitting all kinds of stuff into the air, along with the hundreds of thousands, millions probably, of, quote, industrial plants throughout the world that have been pumping for now over 250, 300 years, soot and debris into the atmosphere. 300 years. To believe that all of that, again, 300 years, now obviously in the whole 300 years, there was not clearly you know, a couple of million, however many plants there are today, pumping that kind of sludge into the earth, into the air. That's really only been the last 150 years. Which, if you think that, you know, saves you, oh, well, that's just, that's really not that long a period of time. You're right, it's not that long a period of time. But I want you to really think about how much has changed in the last 150 years. I really want you to think about what has changed, how much in 150 years. I was talking with somebody, I've mentioned this before, in the late 2000s, 2009, 2010s, they were 92, still driving. And they were pointing out things that looked like nothing to me. Divots, concrete center blocks, walls that seemed to go nowhere, parks, all kinds of stuff. And telling me what they used to be and how the community was put together. He was 92. He was born in, I think, 1909? No. That would be wrong. 1919. No, 1918. Either way. As he put it, when he was a kid, you saw more horses than you did motor vehicles. You saw, if you went west, you still saw people driving wagons, building log cabins. This was in the 1910s and 1920s and 1930s. All of that changed in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, or most of it changed anyway. There was still stuff in the 70s and the 80s, too. But really, by the 90s, you know, by the time he hit his 70s, the whole world was transformed, and it shocked him. So if you're like, well, 150 years isn't that much, it's a lot of change has taken place. But I will acknowledge that thinking underscores a major issue when it comes to talking to people, ordinary people, about what is happening with the climate. It's been pointed out many times before. Trying to explain to the average person the climate crisis is like trying to explain, and I'm going to use my own analogy here, or metaphor actually. It's like trying to explain to the average person with no knowledge of the human body, not only how each system works, because most humans would be able to get that, but the microscopic details that go into enabling you to walk, what your brain actually does, how the impulse from the brain go down the spine, and what that then triggers in your legs, and all of that. And doing it, and having them understand it in 2 or 3 days, while they're still living their life. The wealthy have created a system, capitalism, which departmentalizes everything. And because it departmentalizes everything, the average person in that system is not trained and encouraged. They are not encouraged to think in terms of systemic realities. In fact, they are discouraged to do so. And if they refuse that discouragement, then they are co-opted. And if they refuse to be co-opted, then they are ostracized. If they still refuse to go away, then they're either put in jail or exiled or put to the margins of society. And if that still doesn't work, ask Martin and Malcolm. The average person isn't trained to think like this. So I have very deep sympathy and compassion for people. Where my sympathy and compassion ends is when these people refuse to acknowledge their own shortfalls. When they refuse to look at, okay, I don't know exactly how much I know, or I don't know exactly what I need to know, or how much I know, but I know I don't know enough, so let me try to, you know, do the research on this. No, instead of that, with their denial in tow, they go down these rabbit holes of conspiracy that means nothing. That means nothing. And they do so happily because it allows them to disconnect from the world. So it bugs me beyond no belief. This is why I'm doing this, because we do have to make a choice to save ourselves. And that's going to mean getting over our denial and looking at things realistically. Let me help out conservatives with something. Paul Jay conducted a chilling, absolutely chilling interview with, and I can't believe I'm mucking up his name right now. I'm a big fan of his too. He's done some great stuff. Used to be the Secretary of State. I'm sorry, the Chief of Staff for Secretary of State Colin Powell. And I'm not going to be able to think of his name right now. But he attended a conference with the military about climate change. Now, for all of you out there who love the military, let me help you out with something. The military isn't you. The military acknowledges climate change as the greatest, not the second, not the third, not the fourth, not the distant future, the greatest threat on national security presently and into the future. The military. Oh, I love the troops. It's easy to say it. But the military contradicts all of you. The military says it's a problem now and will be getting worse. We have to decide whether or not to save ourselves. I have had for some time a theory which scares the hell out of me. And that theory is that there is a portion of the population that loves chaos. Now, I've mentioned the book before, The Authoritarians. Read that book, listen to the audiobook, which kind of backs me up on this. There's a group of people in this country and in this society that loves chaos. And I believe that many of those people are the ones pushing the theories, downgrading climate change from the real emergency that it is to a hoax. Because once when chaos starts to ensue, they can gather together their little minions and cause destruction and mayhem and slaughter. And they can do so for their own benefit. They can do so for their own benefit. We have to decide on whether or not we want to save ourselves. Now, while climate change is the most forcefully evident crisis that we're going to have to sidestep, so isn't the fact that at a moment in history when we need a fully engaged and intact federal governing system, there has been a prolonged 40-year battle to shave away the structures, the institutional memory structures, that would allow the federal government to act in a way that would then protect as many Americans as it could when this major crisis, which is climate change, strikes big. Recently, Joe Biden and the Congress passed the infrastructure bill. And in describing the infrastructure bill, Joe Biden has called it a once-in-a-generation investment. And I laugh every time he says it. He said it during the State of the Union. I laugh. Why? Even the most conservative engineering group that has looked at the United States' aging infrastructure, most of which was put into place in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. Meaning the youngest, and I'm not, look, there was stuff done in the 70s, 80s, and 90s too, but the most, I mean the bulk, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. Even the most conservative engineering group says, look, America's going to need between $10 and $20 trillion into this aging infrastructure, which, one, is aging, two, was never meant to carry the loads that it's carrying today. 10 to 20. And Joe Biden is happy with 1.3 or 5 or whatever they did, which most of which went to no bid and bid contracts. That means you're going to get less work for more money. Because that's how a lot of these things work. So I laugh when he says, once in a generation, when there are estimates that within 10 years, the United States could be spending $1 trillion plus alone just to clean up the messes that are created by climate change. Alone. So that means this bill is supposed to be enough for the next 10 years. 1.5 trillion, right? 150,000 every year. Oh, I'm sorry, 150 billion every year. A lot of money. The Pentagon and the defense industries and the intelligence industries have over $1 trillion every year, and most likely between $1.25 and $1.5 trillion a year, which is even more money. But we're supposed to only spend domestically $150 billion each year during a time period of increasing climate cataclysm. Makes no sense. We have to make a choice on whether or not to save ourselves. In 10 years, the United States may be spending, and it's probably an overshoot. It'll probably be between $500 and $900 billion rather than over $1 trillion. But still, once in a generation investment is absolutely ludicrous. When in 10 years, in 2032, it's likely we're going to be spending somewhere between $500 billion and $1 trillion, maybe more, just to clean up the aftermaths of climate change. That doesn't even count reinforcing infrastructure that is crumbling. There is a moment in time where people have to get real about what is before them. When I walked into my house when I was 16 years old, and I went to wake my mother up and she wouldn't wake up, and then she sat up lumberly and tried opening her eyes, and I saw the whites in her eyes, I knew something was wrong. I had been in denial. My mother had been slowly dying in front of my eyes for weeks. Later, years later, I would meet the paramedics who actually showed up and took her to the hospital. You know what he told me? When we were leaving the town, we passed by the bowling alley. And as we were leaving through, you know, past the bowling alley, we already knew she wasn't going to make it. We already knew she wasn't going to make it. I tell you this because we are in a moment in time where what we do in the next 5 years, individually, we always talk about communally, but this is an individual choice. What we do in the next 5 years, individually, is going to impact the health and well-being of this country for the next 20 to 30. Now, granted, look, I don't want to play. Things are going to get rough, I still think, anyway. But we can soften it, as the Hopi say. Now, why do I say this is an individual rather than a communal effort? Because if a million people in a region individually decide that they're going to dedicate themselves to something different, that's going to be positive, that's going to be stirring, that's going to be uplifting, that's going to be salvational, you know what happens? They form a new community mindset. And it changes the area in which they live. But see, it has to be individual first. People marvel, and I've heard right-wingers say this, friends of mine, marvel at the fact that millions of people come out and protest to support Chavez and Maduro in Venezuela. And one of them finally asked me the question, but he's a dictator. Why do they support him? And I laughed. I didn't laugh loud, but I laughed. I was, what are you laughing about? And I go, let me show you something. Pull out my phone. This is an aerial picture of the people who are supporting the overthrow of Maduro. A lot of people, right? Goes, yeah, look at that. There's a ton of people. I'm like, here's a second aerial view. He's like, oh, they only cover like a block in a little bit. And I go, yeah, here's the picture. Here's the rally that you were just asking me about. Here's the first view. Okay, there's a lot of people, but why? And I go, whoa, whoa, whoa. Here's the same aerial view that I just showed you. And he goes, wow, holy, wow, wow. They're like all over the place. Like, there are several, probably a dozen or more blocks. Why are they supporting somebody who is hurting them so bad? And I said, that's the problem, my man. You think Maduro is evil, that he's a dictator, because you have been told that by the people you listening to. These people know what he's about. Well, then why is that first group, And I go, because the first group has a financial stake in seeing him leave office, while this group, the bigger group, has a financial stake in having him stay. These people, one by one, chose to save themselves, not because they wanted to protect the dictator. He didn't scare these people to come out. Hell, he didn't even scare the ones who wanted him out of office to come out. And he could have if he was a dictator. They understood what the consequences of inaction would be, just like the other group did too. They understood that the consequences of inaction might result in more Maduros. Well, my friend, I said to him, it is going to create more Maduros. You know why? Because the masses of the people on an individual level are with him, just like they were with Chavez. Not because those men were dictators, like the U.S. says. I mean, come on, let's be fair. If they were dictators, the U.S. would support them. You know the number of dictators in South America, in Africa, and throughout the world that the United States has supported through, you know, the last 70 years? Too many. You can't count them. Hands and feet included. You might be able to do it with your teeth, but I doubt it. Yeah, I doubt it. They know where their best interest lies. And so they understand that the opposition is going to come out and try to show that they are the greater strength when they're not. They are outnumbered significantly. The opposition to Maduro are middle class people who hate him, not because he's done them dirty, but because he won't let them be psychopathic. He won't let them be narcissistic. He won't let them be exploitative to the extent that they destroy the social culture and fabric that exists in the country. And the United States is punishing him for it. Because in the United States, the middle and upper class who do that are protected. His eyes were a little bit big after I said a lot of that. He didn't believe me. I didn't expect him to. He could not still understand why the Venezuelans were supporting this terrible man. And I go, no, I told you why. You just don't want to accept it. Whatever. They made a choice to save themselves. And they understand what saving themselves means. That's the difference between you and them. They know what it means to save themselves. You're engaged in fantasy. You believe by ignoring the death in front of you that the death is going to go away, that it's going to be reversed. One of my other friends who I was talking about this with, who is more middle, center of the road liberal, not too overly radically progressive and not too underhandedly conservative. Him and I were talking one day about my mother and my father and their deaths, because he had just lost somebody in his life. And he was like, man, you know, I knew it was coming, but I couldn't... The pain, man, like I tried to ignore it, just go on day by day, but it just, and I don't want to like let it get me. And I was like, what do you mean let it get you? Well, man, because if I start to cry, I may never stop. And I go, well, I've been there, I've done that. He goes, what, never stopped crying? And I go, yeah. Where you just feel like the tears aren't going to stop coming? Yeah. Where, you know, you break down on the floor because it just hurts so bad that you miss them so much. He was like, man, I can't do this. I can't do this. I gotta. And I'm like, look, dude, it's going to come out sooner or later. Sooner or later, you're going to have to deal with the pain. Yeah, I can't do it now, though. I can't do it now. He was off. White guy, I know, right? I saw him about a year later, And the guy who, you know, beautiful soul guy, man, he looked tired. You know, and I said, you know, did you get through the process, man? You know, did you grieve? Oh, man, you know, I kind of did, but, you know, it's just what it is. It's life. And I'm like, dude, man, listen, you aren't sleeping well, are you? Oh, man, you can always see me, man. You can always see me. I'm like, son, you gotta give in to the process. I'm going to tell you, you'll feel so much better when you do. A couple of years after that, his wife passed away from a prolonged illness. And he sunk into alcoholism. And that was one of the hardest things that I ever watched happen to a friend. It aged him terribly. The guy was younger than me. And still is. He's still living. If you can call what he's doing living. Because he isn't happy. The point of this story is this, y'all. Denial is a natural state in grief. It is. But when you allow denial to take your life over, you become wrapped up in delusions. You become wrapped up in depression, in despair. And you no longer communicate with the outside world because you're not communicating with yourself. And that's when the intoxications start. You start using drugs to get through the day, sex to get through the day. A lot of us use drugs that we don't even think of as drugs. They're just stimulants, right? Monster drinks, right? Five-hour rock star. All of those things, they're just stimulants to keep us going so we don't feel depressed, we don't feel despair, we don't feel delusioned. We don't feel reality. And we don't feel grief. One of the questions I get a lot, because I'm a very outgoing, happy person, is how do you remain hopeful? And I always say it came from my parents, and I guarantee it came from their parents. But I'll be honest, y'all. As black folks, we've been struggling for so long. What we know about not being happy in the rain? What do we know about not being happy in the rain? You either let it crush you or you let it get you stronger. And we've let it get us stronger in many ways, and it's crushed us in other ways. If you are not ready to accept the world that is unfolding before you, may I suggest you take a brief sabbatical. Give yourself a few months, 3 or 4 maybe, maybe 6. But no more than 6. And then after that, you start doing some journaling. Start describing your world. Start describing your world and why it is the way you think it is. Try not to rely on comfortable words. Oh, it's because of liberals. It's because Democrats. It's because black people. It's because CRT. It's because... No. None of that. The world around you. Even if you have to start with, the world around me is dingy, depressing. That's cool. That's awesome. Make that list. The world around me is... ... Use the words. And then try to limit it to 10. 10 things describing what the world around you are. If you want to go higher, that's fine. But because you're going to take that and you're going to do another exercise. After you make that list, the world around me is depressing. The world around me is sad. The world around me is grief-stricken. The world around me is sort of pleasant, happy even, maybe, possibly. The world around me is ugh. Then what I want you to do, let's say you only use 10. Every week, maybe every 2 weeks, you're going to start another entry, and you're going to take that descriptive, the world around me is depressing, and you're going to do a couple of things. One, you're going to write down, what does depressing mean to you? What do I mean when I say depressing? And then two, what makes the world depressing? What makes the world depressing? Now, you could just list stuff. But then once you're done listing the stuff, you're going to have to go back through and answer the question, why is this making me depressed? Now, to do all of this, you may want to start off by first saying, or starting a entry by saying, I expected from my life when I was a child, and then another entry, I expected from my life when I was a teenager. Pick a year. You can do several years, by the way. But you can start off that way to kind of give yourself a refresher of where you were at when you were at possibly your most opportunistic and optimistic. So you might want to start when you were 15, when you were 14, when you were 13, when you were 17, whatever. This is where I thought I would be when I was 35, when I was 45, when I was 25, when I was blah, blah, blah. And then after you do that, every new entry, you're going to take those things. This is where I thought I would be at 25, 30, 35, 40. And you're going to say, okay, well, why wasn't I where I wanted to be when I was at, when I was 25? Now, some of you will be able to do these all in one entry. But you want to do them nonetheless. And you can always return and add more to them. Because what it's going to do, it'll take you a little bit, it'll take you maybe a year or so, and make time to write a couple of times a week. And I get it if you have kids and what have you, but you can actually start to work with your kids to be like, we're all going to sit down and do homework, and I'm going to write, and we're going to be quiet, we're going to turn off the phones, turn off the television, turn off the internet, and we're just going to get work done together as a family. And this is going to be part of our family time every night. And in the beginning, it's going to be difficult, people are going to want to do other stuff, yada, 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 but within a year, with commitment, all of you will be looking forward to it, and it'll strengthen your bond with one another. So every one of those things that you said, you know, this is where I expected to be when I was 25, when I was 30, when I was... Use a different entry point, again, a different entry every day, a couple of times a week, where you do that, where you talk about why you weren't where you wanted to be. You know, what could you have done to get there? How did this make you feel? Why did you feel that way? Yada, yada, yada. And again, you'll start to notice a pattern. This will put you on a path to self-discovery. This will put you on a path to self-discovery. And sooner, rather than later, you'll actually find the beauty in yourself again. The beauty in yourself again. And then I guarantee you something, y'all. You will make the decision and the determination to save yourself. And so won't those that you touch who engage in this work with you also. Thank you for joining me. If you get some value out of this, please donate. CWB Podcast, CWB as in Class War Battlefield, Podcast, CWB Podcast, You can hit me up on PayPal. You can hit me up on Cash App. $2, $5, $10, $20, $50, whatever you can muster each month, y'all. Drop me $2, drop me $5, drop me $10, drop me $20, drop me $50. If you can afford it, hand it over. I'm kidding. But I really will appreciate it. As I said to you before, I have a goal. You know, my goal really is to be able to do this full time, to do some things that I'm not able to do now because I'm going to be engaged in employment. The goal is between $3,000 and $6,000 a month. Preferably $6,000 to $10,000 a month. Why? Is it because I just want to pocket the money? No. One, I could update my you know, how I do this. I don't plan to lose this sound. I like this sound, so I'm not going to update that. But my computer, you know, I actually want to build one, which I've already priced out everything. It'll cost me about $2,500 for the one that I want to build. Additionally, I want to take some of that money that you give to me, and especially between the $6,000 and $10,000 amount, I can take some of that money and start giving it to other podcasts that really do some great work and don't receive the type of support that they should. So I'm looking to really pay it forward, and I'm asking you to help me do that. Okay? 2, 5, 10, 20, 50, whatever you got. Make it a monthly thing, guys. Help me out. Help me make this thing better so I can keep talking with you. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. I am your brother, Brian Meredith. Oh, Gaia. Until the next one, y'all. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lies in the balance.